You are listening to Living for the Cinema with Jeff Gershon. Welcome to the Living for the Max series. Over the past 45 years, there has been no other film franchise quite as inventive nor as consistently exciting as the Mad Max saga. Four films, mostly chronicling the post-apocalyptic adventures of lone wolf Max Rockatansky, played three times by Mel Gibson, and most recently by Tom Hardy. As each of these films has been directed by Australian cinematic genius George Miller, they have each reflected his unique vision while also being hugely influential on pop culture, more specifically the action genre. Therefore, over the next several months, I will be revisiting each entry of this beloved franchise each month, leading up to the U.S. release of Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, on May 24th. Mad Max Fury Road, which came out in 2015, and was directed by George Miller. It stars Charlize Theron, Tom Hardy, Nicholas Hoult, Hugh Keyes-Bine, Josh Hellman, Nathan Jones, Zoe Kravitz, Rosie Huntington-Whiteley, Riley Keough, Abby Lee, Courtney Eaton, John Howard, Richard Carter, and Iota. The genre would be post-apocalyptic action thriller.
My world is fire and blood.
Everything is dependent on oil.
We are killing for gasoline.
The world is almost out of water.
Water.
Now there's the water wars.
Here they come again.
Out here, everything hurts. You want to get through this? Do as I say. Now pick up what you can and run.
Oh, what a day! What a lovely day!
What's your name?
As cliched as it has been over the past 9 years to lavish this film with gushing praise, I gotta say that after the sixth or seventh rewatch, including three times in theaters, that this movie is 100% deserving of those plaudits. This film is literally the textbook definition of a ride, in every sense.
I am the scales of justice! Conductor of the choir of death!
And that comes very much from its simplicity. It's basically a straightforward A to B, back to A story, with a couple of detours, mind you, but it rarely slows down nor loses momentum. And yes, like its two predecessors, the character of Max, played by Tom Hardy, is in fact the special guest star in a story bearing his name.
A man reduced to a single instinct, survive.
I know. This was a point of some unwarranted controversy when this came out in 2015, as not only was Charlize Theron playing Furiosa as prominent in the marketing, but upon first watch, it was clear that Hardy's take on this character was even less dialogue-driven than his predecessor, and roughly 40% of the runtime, you could barely see his face in this movie. I mean, despite the dramatically different ways in which they start off and their stories develop, both Road Warrior and Thunderdome concluded from the point of views of the supposed real protagonists of their stories, via voiceover. Max comes into the lives of these folks and has a huge impact on their stories, but it's their stories at the end of the day. The primary storytelling note at the end of each of those movies is that in the Road Warrior, the gasoline tribe safely got away with all their supply intact.
The precious juice was hidden in the vehicles. As for me, I grew to manhood, and the Road Warrior, that was the last we ever saw of him. He lives now only in my memories.
And at the end of Thunderdome, that the Lost Boys and girl made it to Tomorrow Morrowland safely. And what's triumphant at the end of Fury Road is that Furiosa and crew get back to the Citadel, where she is now calling the shots. Speaking of which, Charlize is fantastic here, even with minimal dialogue herself. Hers is a forceful, charismatic, and sufficiently sympathetic presence.
You've done this before?
Many times. Now that I drive a war rig, this is the best shot I'll ever have.
And them?
They're looking for hope.
What about you?
Redemption.
It's very much a physical performance aided by pitch-perfect makeup, accentuating those eyes, and the bald dome, plus the missing arm, of course. So much of what drives her presence here obviously comes from superior character design. But when she shouts, screams, glances, grunts, grabs the wheel, Charlize makes each moment count. This is not taking anything away from Hardy as the titular Max. Now, at first it feels as if his take on this character is a bit more slapsticky than Mel Gibson's was, since so much of the first 40 minutes we spend with this Max has him playing all types of comical frustration. He's running furiously through caves, grimacing under his blood bank mask, or just grunting. But Tom Hardy has always grunted or growled quite well. Better than most. That's part of what has always made his screen presence so unique. He commands your attention as he does here. And as the story progresses, he's using those eyes to maximum effect to visualize how he is on the same page as Furiosa. Bottom line, this is a story of action told in generally broad strokes, with Nicholas Hoult's sublime performance portraying Warboy Nux as its not-so-secret weapon. As an actor, Hoult has always just proven again and again that when he plays against his runway model-like good looks, he can be a truly special actor capable of pulling off anything on screen. His character Nux has arguably the only full-on character arc of all the major players, and it's no accident that his dialogue scenes with Riley Keough's Capable, yes, that is the name of her character, that's how she's credited, Capable, aboard the war rig, roughly halfway through, these are arguably the film's most touching scenes.
Three times the gates were opened to me.
What gates?
I was awaited in Valhalla. They were calling my name. I should be walking with the immortal, no feasting with the heroes of all time.
I'd say it was your manifest destiny not to.
I thought I was being spared for something great. I got to drive a pursuit vehicle. For a while, even Larry and Barry stopped chewing on my windpipe.
Every set piece is masterfully executed, and some even stand out as their own distinct vignettes, both well integrated into the story, but also strong enough to stand on their own if you just have 5 to 10 minutes to watch them on YouTube, which I know many of us have done. Both the massive sandstorm and the long-distance firefight at night, these are not just kick-ass action sequences, but they're both just gorgeous to look at, thanks to impressive color grading. We just have not seen deep blues or fire-red oranges like this before on screen. And that brings us to the categories. Because this is the Living for the Max series, the first category would be the Moment of Madness. From the get-go, the Mad Max series has become widely known for jaw-dropping action sequences, often made possible by death-defying stunt work. And the Moment of Madness would be the best demonstration of that for this particular entry in the Mad Max saga. Now, I'm going to go a little more low-key here, but it's an important sequence. I'm talking about a half hour in, and this is the first real meeting of our two main protagonists, Max and Furiosa. And their relationship is firmly established just within their first hand-to-hand fight when they first meet. And it's quite a fight. Each approaches the other with feral aggressiveness. Chains, masks, and missing arms be damned. And if one of them happens to be chained to Nux the whole time, well, forget about him too. It's all about this fight. And we can also see how that animosity between them starts to ease up as they begin to trust each other more throughout the story. The next category would be the best needle drop. This is the best song cue or piece of score used throughout the runtime of the film, because music is essential to film. Now, disappointingly, Tina Turner did not return to perform any more amazing original songs this time around, and we are back to an original score comprising the music for a Mad Max story. But fortunately, it's one hell of a score. It's conducted by one of the more prolific rising star composers of the past decade. That would be Netherlands-owned, straight out of Lichtenvoorde, if I'm pronouncing it right, Tom Hulkenberg, otherwise known professionally as Junkie XL. According to IMDb, Tom is a full contact composer, meaning that he's hands-on at every stage of the composing process. Good way of describing him, as he's become very much a go-to guy for many a franchise in recent years, including Deadpool, Divergent, and previous episodes Godzilla vs. Kong and Batman v Superman. I guess the dude likes versus movies. And his score here for this movie might very well be his best, which makes the fact that it was one of the few areas of this film which was not nominated for an Oscar all the more shocking, because it was deserving for sure. Just full-on balls-to-the-wall propulsive action music, mostly driven by synthesizers and sequencers, but with powerful string orchestration mixed in just to heighten the emotion. And for me, the musical highlight occurs about 50 minutes into the movie as Furiosa and Max have sort of joined forces now, resolved their differences, at least temporarily, as the war rig has stopped at a major pass, basically surrounded by canyons, and they're waiting to be allowed safe passage by the dirt bike gang, I believe they're known as the Buzzards, which Furiosa has cut a deal with.
It's all here! 3,000 gallons of gasoline, just like you asked. I'm gonna unhitch the pod. You drop the rocks.
You said a few vehicles in pursuit, maybe. We count three war parties.
Yeah, well, I got unlucky.
Of course, matters just get increasingly tense as several different convoys are now after Furiosa and crew. As they approach closer to that pass, she calls to Max to start the ignition and... As they take off, the dirt bikes swarm around them. Max and Furiosa start shooting at them from all different directions. Amazing stunt work, by the way. And things just get crazy as the chase is on, with this score ramping up in the background. This is definitely the most aggressive piece of music that we will hear for the remainder of the movie. Violins scraping faster and faster, alternating with crushing synthetic blasts of sound, which almost sound as if they could be reverberating from within the truck itself. This track is referred to as Brothers in Arms. The next category would be wasted talent. This is the most underutilized talent involved with the film. Now, apparently since this film's vaunted release, there is one aspect of it which has received the biggest backlash. Well, a slight backlash, I guess, and has possibly aged the worst in some folks' minds. Even those who love this film otherwise, and that would be Tom Hardy's performance.
I am the one who runs from both the living and the dead.
I mean, I don't know. I guess I kind of noticed it at points seeing this movie. His accent and verbal affectations seem to change between scenes. And akin to his Bane performance in The Dark Knight Rises, it even sounds at points as if the volume of his speaking voice has been dubbed too loudly given his surroundings.
You know, hope is a mistake. If you can't fix what's broken, you'll go insane.
And I'll say this, I don't think he's quite as good in this role as Mel Gibson was in the previous three. But given that, I just don't think it really hurts the movie particularly. It's more of a purely physical performance, and like I said earlier about his grunting and his eyes, on that front he delivers and never holds the film back.
Max. My name is Max. That's my name.
And even beyond him, I don't believe that any other talent was wasted in the production of this film. Everyone was at the top of their games. That brings me to the trailer moment. This is the scene or moment that best describes this movie. Now, we don't need any particular exposition scenes establishing Rosie Huntington-Whiteley's The Splendid Angerod. That's the name of her character, The Splendid Angerod. We can see everything we need to know in how she handles herself as a human shield during one particularly intense high-speed exchange early on in the story, at roughly the 60-minute mark. This particular scrape-up might also be one of the more exciting set pieces in the film for that very reason.
That's my child, my property.
Just that look of assured defiance which she gives Immortan Joe, played by Hugh Keyes Byrne, giving an impressive physical performance even underneath so much cover-up, as she is hanging off the side of the war rig, well, it is a tense and powerful moment. And yes, it is followed up by something quite tragic, but overall, that whole sequence just grabs you and never lets go. It's very likely the most emotionally charged moment of the film.
Stop! Turn the rig around! Go back for her!
No.
Tell him to turn the rig around!
Did you see it?
She went under the wheels.
Did you see it?
She went under the wheels.
And that brings us to the final category, and that would be the MVP, the person or people who are most responsible for the success of this film. Of course, the primary focus of George Miller's long-delayed opus is not character growth, it's action. And when I say delayed, I mean long-delayed. There was the writing of the script, the pre-production, storyboards in the 90s. Twice in the early 2000s, production was stopped before it could start as a result of world events. And things got delayed even further as a result of unusually good weather in the desert outback, believe it or not. So yeah, we're talking about at least a 20-year delay. But yes, it was never about character growth. It was always about action. And thanks to top-flight technical work across the board, this fourth entry in the Mad Max saga more than delivers in that area. This film deservedly won 6 Oscars for sound, production design, makeup, sound editing, costume design, of course, and most importantly, editing. Done by Margaret Sixel. Yes, George Miller's wife and longtime collaborator. Sixel had the unenviable task of whittling down more than 450 hours of footage shot over 2 years out in the desert into something cohesive, relying mostly on his storyboards, of course, and many of which were developed by Miller 20 years prior. That this film turned out as well as it did is something of a minor miracle. You had dozens of top-flight stunt crew, including several Cirque du Soleil alumni, performing most of the auto-based insanity in camera, resulting in a story which is mostly told through action, which makes it all the more impressive. I mean, just another example. Zoe Kravitz's Toast the Knowing. Yes, that's her character, Toast the Knowing. Yeah, they really got wordy with those names. During her moments of gathering up firearms and ammo in the war rig, she is clearly adaptive and resourceful. And that's all we get to know about her, and that's all we need to know.
Well, we've only got 4 for Big Boy here, so he's all but useless. But we can squirt off this little pinky raunchy 29 times.
All these elements really come together beautifully thanks to the tireless efforts and creativity of 2 individuals. Yes, you heard that right, 2 folks. I'm referring to the dynamic duo who spent much of 2 decades crafting and finishing the ultimate action movie. George Miller and Margaret Sixel are your co-MVPs.
Did you disagree about anything in that editing?
A lot. She did say to me, I'm here to stop you embarrassing yourself. and she did. And she's got a much lower boredom threshold than I have.
Wow.
So she'll get very bored with repetition. And you know, it's not just stringing whole bits of action together, because it can become very boring. It's looking for some very strong causal connection.
My rating for Mad Max Fury Road is 5 stars out of 5. Overall, Miller and crew did not just deliver a satisfying, rousing action adventure to rival the best of them, regardless of franchise. I'm talking about T2, Aliens, Hard Boiled, Die Hard, Skyfall, The Raid 2, Children of Men, Sorcerer, The Matrix.
No one has ever done anything like this.
That's why it's going to work.
He directed a moving image work of art to rival any of them. And if you're looking to watch Mad Max Fury Road, it is now streaming on Apple TV and Max. And that ends another Shiny and Chrome review. Please like, subscribe, and share the Living for the Cinema podcast, and follow and like us on Facebook, Instagram, and Letterboxd. And join us next time for another review from Living for the Cinema.